Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm here in New York and joined by award-winning editor, journalist and author Tina Brown. As the editor of the newly resurrected Vanity Fair in 1984, by the end of her tenure, she had taken its circulation from 200,000 to 1.2 million. In 1992, she became the first female editor of the New Yorker, transforming the title and increasing newsstand sales by 145%. Her books include The Diana Chronicles, a biography of the late Princess of Wales, and The Vanity Fair Diaries, which detailed her years editing the legendary magazine. She's also founder of Women in the World Summits and The Daily Beast, and presenter of TBD with Tina Brown, a podcast which promises to help listeners stay smart in today's fast-moving times. Tina, thank you for joining me.
Good to see you, Paul.
I've been hugely looking forward to this. And we've been bumping into each other for a while because you record TBD with Tina Brown in this studio. And I often see
you meet all the best people in this studio.
Well, I certainly do. What's it like to sit in that chair? Because normally you literally sit in the chair I'm in.
I'm feeling very much on the spot in this chair. You know, I've got quite used to my nice chair over the other side and talking to people. I just had Preet Bharara, you know, the great prosecutor in this morning. And it was just wonderful to talk to him. I must say that's coming very soon.
Well, look, there's so much to talk about, but let's start with the 10th Women in the World Summit in New York in April. Did you imagine that the event would spearhead a great awakening in the global women's movement?
Well, it's very exciting, actually, because, you know, we started this nearly 10 years ago when there was hardly anything going really on in this space, as the word goes. And, you know, we talked about I really just saw the beginning, the burgeonings of what I saw as a sort of global women's movement all over the world, where extraordinary women from Africa and India and the Middle East were really kind of fighting for freedom and for equality in such a kind of moving and powerful way that I started this summit in which I could showcase their voices. But in the course of it, I also began to see that, you know, American feminism was in a rather torpid condition compared to the exciting and fiery women that I was seeing all over the world. And I felt it was time to start, you know, addressing sort of American women really about why they weren't more agitated about their own rights compared to the women that we were featuring from overseas. And now, of course, 10 years later, the kind of mission has met the moment. I mean, we were talking about, you know, rape as a weapon of war and, you know, sexual harassment in the workplace and all of these issues, which, of course, have become topic A now since Me Too and Trump. And we've seen really a kind of second, a renaissance of feminism. Young girls who, you know, when we started thought feminism was an uncool thing to be interested in. Now it's the cool thing to be as a feminist. It's exciting.
How on earth can feminism be seen to be uncool?
Well, I mean, there you are. I know. I was asked the other day, you know, what do you say to young women who say that feminism is not relevant? I say, you know, that they must be both lucky and lazy because, you know, if you're not taking advantage of or supporting the rights that are going to help yourself, then I've no time for you in a sense.
Now, the summit's an amazing gathering of the kind of next generation of female leaders and activists. Who are you excited about hearing from on this year's agenda?
Well, Women in the World this year has got an epic lineup. I mean, we have Oprah on opening night. She's going to be...
I've heard of her.
Yeah, you have heard of her. The theme is actually, for the 10th anniversary, is Can Women Save the World? Because frankly, implicit in that is that, you know, men have had many, many thousands of years to get it right. And look at the predicament that we're in.
Oh, we've made a mess of it. I apologise on behalf of all men.
It's a giant, giant bloody mess. And, you know, we have the rise of strongmen all over the world. We have, you know, Trump in the White House. We have...
It's like we're on another planet, isn't it? It all seems to have gone back.
It is such a bad scene that, you know, I don't see how women could make, you know, more of a mess of it, quite honestly. So I think it's an exciting time to ask that question. Like, let's hear from women in all the areas that, you know, they can improve the world. So we've asked Oprah to address that question as the sort of climax of the opening night. And we have, you know, discussions about, you know, can women save the planet? And we have, you know, Cristina Figueres, who's this great, you know, planet campaigner, Earth campaigner. And we have a great discussion about disinformation and fake news and women who are fighting against that, like Carol Cadwalader in The Guardian, who, of course, exposed the Cambridge Analytica case. And Maria Ressa, the great Filipino journalist who has Rappler, you know, which is the investigative conservative news organization in the Philippines, where she has been arrested and she's faced down Duterte. And so we have extraordinary women like that. And then we also have women such as Anna Wintour, Priyanka Chopra, Stacey Abrams, Brie Larson, who's now Captain Marvel. So she's definitely saving the world. Susan Rice. You know, it's a very exciting lineup, actually.
You are right. The lineup is incredible. And what do you think the outcomes will be? I mean, what's the fundamental purpose of it?
The fundamental purpose is to really focus on, in a really sort of, high-level way, about the solutions that women can bring to the table. So in all of our discussions, and we've always done this, actually, the one of the underlines was sort of stories and solutions that women in the world.
Because so to actually mobilize.
To mobilize. I mean, we don't do the kind of the sort of bloviations about, you know, lean in and you know, how to get to the corner office and what I call empowerment venting. I'm not interested in empowerment venting. What I'm interested in is hearing from women who have genuinely done extraordinary things and have a hit list of stuff to share about how others can emulate. And I think that's why people find the summit so energizing, because actually person after person leaves that summit and either gives money to a cause, becomes mobilized personally to engage with, you know, a cause, has their mind open to what's happening in the world. One of the great missions of Women in the World has been really to sort of to see the world through the eyes of women. I mean, for me, the most sort of heartening thing when I go out in the corridors of the summit is to hear people saying, I never knew this was happening, you know, in India. I never knew this was happening, you know, in Somalia or wherever it is. Because they haven't really paid attention to that. I mean, it's not something they're reading or hearing about, because foreign news gets very little attention. And then bringing it home is really about, well, if they're doing this, what am I doing here, you know? And I think it's also really important to understand how tough it is, you know, in other places compared to the freedoms that we take for granted. I mean, we have two incredible women this year from Uganda who are gay, and they've been in love for many years. And, you know, homosexuality is illegal in Uganda. It's outlawed. It's not just illegal, it's actually shamed, you know. And these women are really living their life in hiding, and they have done for many years, but their love has prevailed. It's disgraceful. And I mean, you know, women there are evicted if they're found to be gay. They're fired if they're found to be gay. They're shamed, harassed, persecuted. So to have these two women come and tell us, I mean, we are very mobilized in the US, obviously, rightly so, about LGBTQ rights. But just think about being in Uganda, being a woman who's not allowed to choose the person you love, and not just that, you know, harassed and outlawed for it. It's really an interesting thing to know about and to get behind.
And frankly, this is an incredibly important aspect of straight awareness raising, because if they're not speaking at your conference, then fewer people are going to hear about this
exactly.
And then have a chance to,
exactly.
frankly, to do exactly. something about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And we've had so many incredible outcomes. You know, in Toronto, for instance, we took an amazing woman, a Bangladeshi doctor who actually is Canadian. Works in Calgary, and she works with the Rohingya Muslims who are persecuted, and she has just come back from camps where she saw the appalling things that were happening. And at the summit was also Justin Trudeau, who's been very supportive of Women in the World. And she said to me, do you think you can arrange, you know, for me to talk to him? And I said, of course, he'll be in the green room. And I put them together in the green room. And she asked him if there was any way that Canada could, condemn the genocide and call it a genocide of the Rohingya. And 2 weeks later, he did. And that kind of thing happens at Women in the World constantly, of being able to bring together women who have extraordinary experiences, extraordinary passions, extraordinary missions, and put them together with very high-profile people they would never meet otherwise, who can actually affect their lives.
And this is the 10th year. I mean, what are your strongest memories of the previous summits? You know, what have been the abiding memories of the previous nine? There must be a litany of successes.
There have been, actually. It's been really incredible. Hillary's been...
It's very, very inspiring.
It is. Hillary Clinton has been every year except the year that she was running. We've had so many moments with Hillary. The great moment when she and Christine Lagarde grasped hands and did a great sort of power hand clasp together, which kind of went all over the world. It was kind
I remember
of inspiring.
The image. It was iconic.
Yeah, it was an iconic picture. We have many, many iconic pictures like that. You know, we've had, let's say, Justin Trudeau, who came and of course, brought the house down. You know, we've had, the Indian movie star, Amir Khan, who was another kind of unexpected guest, but he's a huge feminist. And he was another sort of unexpected, enormous hit, Scarlett Johansson, talking about, you know, just kind of chastising Ivanka Trump from the stage, which kind of went everywhere. You know, it's been a really remarkable 9-10 years, and we're very excited about this year. It's just going to be, I think, a culmination of that excitement.
And I don't want to bore our listeners with like the logistics of putting the event on, but it must knacker you because there's so many things that you have to coordinate. Do you take a 2 weeks off to recover afterwards?
We have, I think it's like 52 women coming from like 12 countries, you know. I mean, it's unbelievable. The visa problems, the kind of ego problems at times, you know, the question of the Rubik's Cube about, you know, this person can come only on the Wednesday, this one coming on the Tuesday, they're supposed to be talking to each other. How are we going to fuse those two things? It's amazing. And it goes on until the bitter last moment, you know, with people changing and changing. It always seems to come together with a kind of wonderful magic at the end. And, you know, what we do is not a conference. It's really a show, you know, because actually what I've done, I think, is do something different. I called it live journalism from the beginning. Never a conference, always live journalism. And I'm interested to see that that term has now been taken up in many other places. I was sort of slightly mocked for it the first time I used it. And now I notice that the Washington Post is calling it live journalism. It's very much got a news edge, you know. I mean, we did the sexual harassment of a female firefighter, you know, a year before anything happened with Me Too. You know, we did the rise of white supremacy, you know, 2 years before Charlottesville. You know, we did, Saudi. This has been a very big sort of passion of ours. This year, actually, we're going to have a major discussion about what's happening to persecuted, you know, dissenters in Saudi in the face of all of the ridiculous PR that MBS, you know, put out before he ended up, you know, slicing up, you know, Jamal Khashoggi. So we do think we have very much got a news edge. So it is live journalism. And it's also, I pace it very much like I did an issue of Vanity Fair. You know, we start always with something that's very journalistic, very much a topic of our times. We're actually one of our sort of great discussions this year is going to be, you know, whether anything much has been achieved in the last 2 years by this huge upsurge. We have the prosecutor in the R. Kelly case joining the stage, along with Ashley Judd, who is the first voice, of course, against Harvey Weinstein. And a transgender rights activist is joining that discussion, as well as Rebecca Traister, who's, of course, the writer. And it's a great panel moderated by Katie Couric. And then we'll go to something that has a lot of heartstrings to it. You know, a Uyghur woman from a Chinese woman whose relatives have all been arrested and were herded up by the Chinese regime. And then we'll go to a movie star. We'll have Brie Larson, you know, talking about being Captain Marvel. So it's actually very much like I would do an issue of Vanity Fair, with the sort of the grit, the heartstring story, narrative, personal narrative, you know, a great movie star to just bring you that, you know, relief and sense and sort of fun. And I think that's really why people find it very compelling, because it's that mix. People don't want to have all serious, earnest content, nor do they want to have fluff, 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 but they do want to have a mix. And
light and shade.
Light and shade.
So how do people get tickets then? Because I gather some are still available.
It's April the 10th to the 12th. It's at Lincoln Center. There's still a few tickets left. If you want to go on the Lincoln Center David Koch Theatre website, you'll see tickets for Women in the World, or go to womeninTheWorld.com. End of plug.
Tell us about the podcast. You've had much bigger, more impressive names than me. I'm incredibly jealous.
I love doing a podcast.
It's great, isn't it?
I love it. It's so much fun. It's the most low-stress thing of all the editing or, you know, broadcasting I've done. The most fun. I just had a hunger just to talk to just really smart people for as long as it took. And I still feel that, you know, the gap in the market is still, you know, intelligence, you know, and there are some great things out there. But the joy of just being able to let smart people develop their ideas without being kind of harassed by trying to cram it into a New York minute, as it were, is very, very appealing. And I have also very much my own sort of blue stocking side as well, you know. So I love to be able to talk, for instance, to Professor Stephen Greenblatt, you know, the great Shakespeare scholar who wrote his wonderful book Tyrant, about Shakespeare's tyrants, and have him talk about how a nation can be seeded for the advent of a tyrant. And the most wonderful thing about talking to him was he's so interesting about all this. And you're like, he's never talking about Trump, except he is talking about Trump all the way through it. I mean, the book is just completely riveting. So I love talking to him. And then I love talking to someone like Michael Douglas, who's just like a great showboat, who's just got amazing stories. Or Preet Bharara, who, you know, who's such a fascinating guy. We had a wonderful woman as well. Some of my Women in the World women I get to talk about talk with at greater length. I had on as a guest Topeka Sam, who's a wonderful, wonderful woman who was on our stage last year. She is a woman. She was a formerly incarcerated woman. She was, she was incarcerated for dealing drugs. And while she was in prison, she realized just how bad it is for women in prison, and how she was going, when she got out, she was going to create a halfway house that was much more than that. That was actually a place where women could come and just, be able to live after prison in a clean, welcoming environment where they could get themselves on their feet and look for a job and be helped in the next stage of their lives, called Hope House. And I mean, she's just a wonderful mission and an amazing woman. I went to see Hope House, which is in Queens, and I was just so touched by this entire organization, and feel that she has this extraordinary mission to proliferate it all over the US. And, I'm right behind her. So it was wonderful to be able to have her on the show and let her sort of develop those thoughts. And yet, we also had Hillary Clinton, who was able to kind of ruminate about, why it is that women have to be likable when they run for office. She was great on all that. So it's great. I'm loving it. I'm really enjoying it.
And what kind of feedback have you got from the listeners? They must be enjoying it too.
They are enjoying it. It has got a great reception, actually. It's been listed in various, best of lists. And I think people are discovering it. I deliberately didn't go out with a kind of big song and dance about the fact that I was doing it. I feel a little gun shy about doing that. I thought I'll just put it up one day and let people find it. We got a big following in England, it seems, which is interesting. I mean, I love being able to see where people are listening. For some reason, I have a whole bunch of people listening in Iran. I don't know why that is. It's a bit sinister. But I love seeing where they're listening.
The listener's a listener.
The listener's a listener.
That's what I've always thought.
I used to love that about the Daily Beast, too. When I was editing the Daily Beast, there was this marvelous sort of mapping thing that was in the lobby, which showed where your readers were, your users were, all over the world. And you'd suddenly put up a story about Paul Blanchard and see that like 25 people in Bulgaria had logged on. And you just kept thinking, like, who are these Bulgarians who are interested in Paul Blanchard? But, this is what life is today. It's quite wonderful the way you can just find your audience. It doesn't matter where they are.
But also some of the metrics can be heartbreaking, because if it's a web article that, Google's analytics have this bounce rate, which is people that decide they're not interested in under a second. Our hosting company can give us metrics on when people give up, out of the 700 people that didn't listen to episode 32, they all gave up at minute 36. And you think, what is it about minute 36 that made them give up?
It's impossible not to get a bit obsessed about that, I'm afraid. It's always in the end about, could you keep your audience? But that also keeps you sort of engaged with the world too. And sometimes, they're fascinated by something you never expected. They really are. I mean, I didn't expect Stephen Greenblatt, the Shakespeare professor, frankly, to get any audience, but he was one of the best ones. It's like people were just, I guess it was January, it was right after Christmas, and people were in a Shakespeare mood.
I've had that before, because I tried to cover lots of different topics, and I had a gentleman on recently called Ken Hertz. He's a Hollywood dealmaker and a lawyer. And I thought it'd be quite interesting about the mechanics of how films and were put together. But actually, it was much more deeper than that. He was talking about fame itself and about the journey where people move to Los Angeles to try and make it in Hollywood, and lots of people are still waiting tables 30 years later, and how random it is, and how the profound psychological consequences of either making it in Hollywood or not. It was fascinating.
Well, that's great. When I saw you done that, actually, I've got it queued up, waiting to listen to, because I actually did think it sounded really quite fascinating. And I thought to myself, well, you're very smart getting into that community too, because you never actually hear from those kind of people much. We hear all about the sort of front of house people, the stars, and even producers and directors. But actually, there are a lot of really smart people in entertainment. Hugely smart. I mean, obviously, it's the most powerful industry in a way, and there's a lot of great minds in it. And I used to love it. When I was at Vanity Fair, I used to spend a lot of my time with those kind of people, Hollywood lawyers and agents and
the deal makers.
The deal makers and the just the people who you never read about, really.
But you've actually said recently that the zeitgeist right now isn't about celebrities, it's actually news. And is everything coming back in politics, to Trump's America now?
It is.
It's unavoidable.
It is unavoidable. And it's very funny, because sometimes on my podcast, I'll have an advertiser, who says they don't want anything political, to which I say, well, get over it, because, you can interview, frankly, a soccer player, and the next thing is they're talking about, Trump or some aspect of, political, whatever political horror's just gone down. They want to talk about
here in America. Is it about taking a knee?
Exactly,
and
right.
The anthem.
There's not a subject really that hasn't been politicized. In fact, and so everything is now about politics. Everything is really driven by the news. And the main problem is just keeping up with any of it and somehow kind of making cogent sense of it. I mean, there are certain stories that I get really obsessed with. If I had a magazine right now, I would be all over. I mean, this college testing scam story to me is just massive, you know, because it's one of those stories that people are just so angry about it, which is great. So it has all that sort of breakthroughness of the real cultural zeitgeist definer. And I think it's going to be seen as that. And secondly, because it seems to link to so many other things like it. I mean, the Fyre Festival scam, you know, the Theranos scam with Elizabeth Holmes.
I'm obsessed with the Fyre Festival and the Theranos scandal.
Yeah, because it's the same story, really, right? I mean, it's about the obsession with the shiny objects, the obsession with status, but with no work behind it.
A combination of fraud, laziness and deep recklessness.
That's exactly right.
And an inevitability, because they ought to have known even at the inception that it was going to fail, and yet they seem to be deluding themselves as well as other people.
And it's driven in a sense by the obsession with the shiny surfaces of Instagram and all the rest, where we're all pretending everything's so fabulous and cool, and everything is about lifestyle and about, you know, influencers and all of these
I'm
nonsense
guilty.
Words. And you know, and in the end, there's no rigor behind it. And yet anybody successful will tell you, I mean, whether it's a Bruce Springsteen, you know, or a Maria Callas or a Preet Bharara, it's like everything about their success has been about rigor, work.
Graft,
total graft. And they just don't get there without that. And that is never really the subject of people's interest.
And you mentioned about attention deficit. I mean, I spend a lot of time, you know, when I'm in airports and so on social media. And you know, my Instagram, for example, I don't use filters. What I put up there is true. But of course, it's not the whole truth, because the reality of my 90% of my working life is a computer sending emails, dealing with phone calls. Right. No one wants Instagram that. So it is misleading.
It's completely misleading. And it allows, I think, as well, the sort of millennial and younger generation to think that it is all just about that. I mean, I was fascinated that one of the daughters of the, the college scam parents, I mean, once she'd been got in completely wrongly by her parents because she had her scores were absolutely zero to do with, you know, success, she gets into college, one of these elite colleges, and then she doesn't go to any classes either, you know, and so all of her, she becomes this 2 million followed Instagram influencer. And so many of her posts are about, like, you know, colleges, who cares, you know, and like, I missed a class today, tee hee. And, you know, it's like there's not any interest at all in actually doing anything at college once they're in, you know. So you just sort of think, this has got to be the definition of completely sort of decadent values. And of course, the apotheosis of that is sort of Trump in the White House. I mean, his emphasis on the fact that nothing you say matters is probably one of the most corrosive things that I get extremely agitated when a Trump-based kind of person says to me what he said about, I don't know, Otto Wombier, the kid who came back from North Korea brain dead, when he kind of sort of just made as if that wasn't important. And they all reply, it's just words. And you think, wait a minute, how can you say that about an utterance?
What?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what is, it's just words. It's this new mantra.
Yeah, it is.
It's just words. It's horrendous. I mean, when did absolute lying all the time just become, oh, well, it's just words? That, to me, is the beginning of some of this stuff that we're talking about.
There's been hundreds of instances where, you know, any other politician, certain revelations or something that he said would be an immediate resigning matter. And he seems to be above the laws of physics. No one, everyone, unfortunately, is becoming complicit. I remember the New York Times did a huge, incredible piece of journalism about his father's accounts and his tax evasion.
That was a great piece.
Yeah, and they nailed the president. They said, here's the evidence that he's doing it as well. Yeah. It didn't even last a full news cycle.
Not even.
Because he called someone a name.
I think that you and I are the only two people who read it anyway. You know what I mean? Because it was a hugely long, brilliant piece of investigative journalism, but I doubt it. It just didn't penetrate. And that is the scary part.
Does it trouble you, though, as a journalist, that almost his supporters don't care anymore? They, you know, and if you look at, say, Brexit, you know, both sides of the argument haven't used the facts to try and reconcile and come together in the middle, have become ever more entrenched in not listening to each other. And almost the facts are irrelevant. People seem to be making these decisions now on feelings alone.
It's absolutely horrific. And also, of course, the original Brexit referendum votes for Brexit were based on lies anyway, because they were being told, you know, there was all this money going to come from Europe to the National Health Service, and that there were all of these Turks who are going to arrive in the, you know, London from the EU, and all kinds of crazy lies that I heard parroted back, you know, people I knew would say to me, well, I'm going to vote for Brexit because of all the money coming to the national health. You know, it was kind of made up out of whole cloth. But it just got pervaded, you know, by disinformation campaigns, both from the kind of Murdoch press, the Daily Mail, and of course, you know, God knows how many Russian bots. But I mean, it was everywhere. And so now it's like it's forged these tribes, isn't it? I mean, where it's about your identity, not about what you really think. It's like you identify as a Brexit person, or you identify as a Remain person.
We could do this podcast for like 7 hours, I'm certain of it, but this is the only bit where I need some discipline to kind of move things forward. It is, no, I'm having a great time. But I mean, let's go back to that time when you were asked to come to New York and reinvent Vanity Fair. That must have been thrilling and scary at the same time.
It was so exciting, but it's what I wanted more than anything in the world. You know, I had a great sort of longing, in a sense, to come and work in New York. I had a great sort of romantic passion for what I saw as sort of American letters and American magazines, having edited Tatler in the UK and made a success of it as my first sort of young editorship when I was 25. I always loved, you know, the Algonquin Round Table and looking at the pictures of the old Vanity Fair in the 20s of, you know, photographs by Hannigan Hoon and Edward Steichen and, you know, the pieces by, you know, Mencken and Dorothy Parker and all these great writers and so on. And so I had a real romance for the name and the title of Vanity Fair. So when I heard that Condé Nast was going to try to bring back Vanity Fair from the dead, I was tremendously interested in seeing what would happen. And then, of course, we saw that the first Vanity Fair in 1983, when it came back, was a complete turkey, is the truth. And I mean, I looked at it and I thought, what a disaster. You know, he spent all this money on this total turkey of a thing. And I didn't think much more about it until, of course, you know, I describe in my book a series of events that happens that ends up them coming back and offering it to me. And I didn't think for one second that I shouldn't do it. I mean, it was my romantic dream to do it. And
did their previous failure, though, give you a bit more leverage and a bit more freedom to do it your way?
It did. And I'd also been a consultant with them in the summer, which made me, it was a bit like summer camp before school. I was able to look around and think, who's good here and who isn't? What would I do if I was in here? And so, yeah, I mean, there was nothing to lose, let's put it that way. And I was so young, there was nothing to lose. My thing was, I thought, well, I'll come to America for 2 or 3 years and I'll do Vanity Fair. It will work or it won't work. And then I'll come back to London. And I never really thought beyond that. You know, I thought it was just a hell of a great gig, you know, and that's what I wanted. And so I leapt over to America. I actually was offered the job in December when my husband and I were on vacation in Barbados. I was asked to come in for an interview. And of course, I didn't even say that I was like where I was. I just said, I think they assumed I was in the US, but of course I wasn't. I was actually still living in London. I just was on the holiday. But I came in for the interview over Christmas and they offered me the job and they said, we need you to start January the 5th. So I went back to Barbados to see Harry and I said, we're moving to the US. And being Harry, he just said, great, like, I better get the house packed up. And he went off to London, packed up the house, got himself a teaching job at Duke, just to kind of what he thought about what to do. And
your husband is A, one of my heroes, but B, becoming a bit of a friend now. And I'm so privileged to know him.
Oh,
he's a genuine legend.
Oh, I mean, he's amazing. I mean, he was, you know, he's such a great editor himself. And he was completely supportive of me doing this. I think a lot of husbands would have said, what do you mean? What about the living in London and the house? And blah, blah, blah. But he never said any of those things. He just said, you've got to do it. It's fantastic. We'll figure it out. And he went back and got the house packed up and rented and came back, got a teaching job until he had something, random house lined up in the U.S., in New York. And, you know, I took over Vanity Fair living out of the Algonquin Hotel where my sense of that legend quickly dissipated. I realized that it was only now Japanese tourists in the evening or, you know, Iranian hookers and things at night. So I swiftly moved out of there into my own place. But yeah, it was very, very exciting moving into that assignment, aged, you know, just turned 30.
Incredible. I feel like a right loser listening to this.
It was amazing. And the staff, you know, it was in crisis, actually. And I love that. I love a sense of there's a crisis. I've got to come in and turn it round.
Roll your sleeves up
against the clock. How do we get this done? I mean, the first weekend I was there, I just came in with the art department, who were actually very good. It's just that they hadn't been led in any way. It was a horrible looking mess visually. And I just sort of redesigned the magazine soup to nuts, you know, just like gave it clean, strong plain layouts where the pictures would make it, you know, would breathe, and strong, clean headlines. I'm a great believer in legible layouts in which the pictures are the star of the layout, and the headlines are all really pop, you know. Read at the contents page, which is one of my great passions. Contents pages are always underestimated. They've got to grab people from the beginning.
I go to them because I want to know what's in the magazine.
And it has to be written in such a way as to sell, sell, sell. So, you know, I redid all of it with them over the weekend. And that redesign, it stayed there for the next 30 years. It's only just changed, actually, with it really stayed all the way through the Graydon Carter regime. You know, so it was a kind of, you know, we created a prototype that lasted an awful long time. And in fact, only really has begun to change more now under the editorship of Rikita Jones, you know, who took it over a year ago now.
And how do you edit? What are the qualities that you bring to the role as editor that's made you so successful? Is it, you know, that relentless drive, that sense of ambition? Is it attention to detail? How do you...
All of it. I mean, it's all of it. I mean, I have... Well, but it's actually, first of all, it's a passion for stories, right?
I mean,
it's a passion for stories.
And you've either got that or you haven't.
Yeah, I mean, it's a passion for stories. I mean, things get me really juiced up. As I say, I mean, if I had Vanity Fair now, I would be so all over that testing story, so all over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi. And, you know, there are certain stories that are just my kind of passion, you know, and that's what I would be doing now. That's what I brought to the magazine. And one thing I can do very well, I have to say, is I know which writer to give that story to. You know, I mean, I think I'm good at finding talent. I've found a lot in my career, but I also know what they should be writing, which is something different. Many times writers have not got good ideas for themselves. You know, sometimes I meet writers who think they should be doing one kind of story, and I can immediately tell, you know, just from talking to them, where I should guide them to do, what they should be guiding them to do. So I was always very good at matching the story to the writer, and did that a lot. And also getting that mix right. You know, I've often talked about the mix in a magazine, but it has to start with the cover. You want that really show-stopping cover that's glamorous, that's connective, that's newsy. And then you want to have this glorious mix inside of, like, the gritty news story, you know, the beautiful looking thing, the sort of heartstrings thing, the unexpected scandal thing. And it's that whole wonderful melee of things that makes a great magazine. I mean, in a way, a magazine is, I often say, you know, to people, well, a magazine is not just a collection of good articles. You can have, actually, you can have an issue with 10 amazing articles that makes a bad magazine. It's about the combination of things that makes a great magazine.
The experience.
Yeah, the whole experience has to be holistically gratifying. And sometimes people think it's just that a magazine is just articles with a staple through. Put them all in and they're good. But, you know, you could have great writers and it'll prosper. But that isn't so. I mean, it's about the mix and how they play off each other that is what makes an exciting magazine. I mean, it is the ultimate bundle in a sense, right? I mean, it's the bundling philosophy, which is that people... And I think one of the difficulties with the disaggregation of articles is that the bundle is lost. You know, people say, oh, well, they won't read, they'll give no traffic for a foreign story, or they won't get any traffic for an investigative story. That's right, unless it's bundled and marketed with a story that plays off it that is the reverse or has some other flavor to it. Then you might get them to read it. I mean, we would often... You know, we might have lured a writer in with a fabulous, I mean, glorious new Madonna cover. But then inside there would be this great investigative piece, you know, about the fall of Bokassa, the great African dictator, or, you know, some juicy, we did lots of stories about Haiti at the time, which was a big news story. But, you know, it was a combination of those things. It was the Madonna with... The other thing that was a really a big serious story by, you know, a writer who was a terrific literary writer. We had an amazing essay about depression by William Styron, which he turned into his book Darkness Visible. That kind of piece, you know, had to coexist with the other stuff, and that's what made Vanity Fair very compelling. And I had the same philosophy at The New Yorker. I mean, it was done differently in different ways. But when I hired people such as Jeffrey Toobin or Jim Stewart or Malcolm Gladwell, you know, they were writing stories that had absolute sort of relevance of now. And then you would run something elsewhere in the book that would be, you know, a completely escapist piece, which could have run at any time in the last sort of 2 years, you know. And the combination of that, of those pacings, were what was the compelling thing of, I have to read this now. You know, my great philosophy was always, if people say, oh, I love The New Yorker, I keep it in a log basket by my bed, and I think, uh-oh, bad, bad, bad. I don't want it piling up by the bed. I want them to read it this week. I want them to read it now.
Good journalism has to be read.
Absolutely. And read, you know,
in
a white hot fury.
But you are right, though. It's that curated experience. I mean, I still like good old fashioned newspapers because I want to be presented with things that I wouldn't click on. But actually, when I can skim it and see the totality of that, I do want to. I want the editor to draw me in rather than just relying me to kind of click on certain articles in like a kind of cafeteria experience.
I agree. And I also like the emotional hierarchy, you see. I mean, I like... What I don't like about, I mean, I love doing the Daily Beast. It was great, but I had to really get over the fact that it looked the same every day, except for a change of picture. So, I mean, you can't change the layout. It's a very intransigent medium, you know. Whereas an issue of the New York Post, you know, it can be a huge front page with a like picture in your face, headline, whatever. Next day, a completely different look, you know. And that's the hierarchy of the news, and how is it a big story or not? Are you going to get excited or not? And how you play the headline, all those things, you know, you can't do that digitally. It's a very unemotional medium, actually. And I really don't like that about it.
Do you edit by gut feeling when you make the decisions? Because if, for example, you take BuzzFeed's content management system, they will have an article with 8 different headlines and give it to 1 million people. And then within an hour, they'll know which is the most, you know, click-worthy headline that's driving the most clicks. It might be a negative take on it or et cetera. And then they'll just delete the other ones and just go with that. But you obviously, in a print-based experience, you can't do that. So you know, how did you go about doing that?
No, I mean, I kind of felt that, you know, I was the algorithm, you know.
You were a human algorithm. I like
it. I mean, I learned that frankly, my goal was to have the headline that worked right off. I mean, that it was an emotionally connective headline. And even if a piece was quite intellectually dry, you'd want to sell it in such a way as to get that immediate emotional connect. That means now I don't feel it's necessary to keep changing that headline to know what that headline is. I mean, I just think it's lazy, frankly, to be doing that. You know, all that sort of writing 20 headlines to see which one works. I mean, if you need to write 20 to see which one works, you should just go into another profession.
I read The Week religiously. And I
love
have done
The
for
Week.
Minis,
Week is wonderful.
And they have a section that's called Boring But Important.
I love it.
I genuinely make myself read it.
I love it, you see, because that has got the wit to make you read it.
And in the Vanity Fair diaries, you really capture that glitzy mid-80s period brilliantly. But one socialite features quite heavily, which is Donald Trump. Were you on to him at an early stage? And were you even more flabbergasted then when he became president?
I mean, I really was on to him, actually, because I, you know, when he submitted to us to read his book, The Art of the Deal, they wanted us to extract it. And my staff actually rejected it. And I just thought, well, I'd quite like to take it home and read it and see what it's like. So I took it home for the weekend to my house at the beach in Quogg, and I read it. And I said, and I write in my diary, you know, that I like his voice. That I said it's bullshit, but it's authentic bullshit.
Yeah.
And I said I think readers will like, an American will like nothing better. So I saw the appeal actually, and I think all the entries that I have about Trump sort of are on that theme, although he gets to be much darker as the diary goes on. I mean, my last encounters with Trump are when he's in a rage with us because we've published a piece that goes into his bankruptcies and really starts to take him apart, you know, and he didn't like that at all. And Marie Brenner, who wrote the really fantastic piece about Trump in the 90s when he was when she felt that he was a total charlatan.
Well, he is. He's a wrong one, as my nana would have said.
And
it's a throwback.
And she was at a benefit for an opening of a movie. And she's sitting there having dinner. And as she sits having dinner, she suddenly feels something cold and wet down her back. And she looks up thinking the waiter has spilled something. And it's Donald J. Trump, who's actually emptied a glass of wine down her back and then sped off across the room to avoid her catching him out. And I mean, that was an example.
Aggressive bullying and cowardice.
Yeah, aggression, bullying, cowardice, and also a long memory for grievance, because this was like 8 months after the piece came out. So he was like still steaming about it.
I mean, after Vanity Fair, all those years there, you had great success at The New Yorker, boosting circulation, cutting its losses. How was that coming into that? Did people resent a Brit coming in and making all those big changes?
The New Yorker was a whole other fabulous challenge, which required all kinds of different things of me than Vanity Fair. I mean, I had really wanted it to do it in the end because I felt, you know, I was getting tired of the celebrity culture and I was thinking, I can't keep doing covers with, you know, Tom Cruise and Madonna and stuff. I've just got to go back to my own kind of literary loves. You know, I was beginning to feel a hunger for more depth, if you like, in what I was doing. And the New Yorker, of course, didn't see me that way because they saw me. I had just done the cover with Demi Moore, Naked and Pregnant. About 6 months before I got the New Yorker, it was Demi Moore. And so, of course, everyone at the New Yorker thought, oh, God, here comes the Demi Moore editor who's going to come into the New Yorker and bring all this terrible celebrity vulgarity. And, you know, we're going to have a magazine that's totally decimated by the Attila the Hun and we don't want her. And there was all sorts of tremendous, like, angst about it. So I come in and my first meeting, you know, I look around the room. They all assembled in this room upstairs at the New Yorker. I'll never forget it because I looked around the room and it just seemed like it was all men, right? And they were all wearing these, like, Coke bottle glasses. And they looked at me and they just stared at me. And there were so many sort of hostile faces as I talked to them about what my vision of the magazine was, how I wasn't coming, you know, to destroy what they loved. I regarded it as a literary jewel. I simply wanted to bring new talent and all the rest of it.
Did that make things worse?
Yeah. And they were just sitting, it was just silence. There was silence. And then I looked at the back of the room and there was this guy standing there like Frank Zappa with his long hair and his arms folded. And he just sort of looked at me and said, "You're going to kill off the cartoons, aren't you?" And that was Bob Mankoff, the great cartoonist, who I then turned around and made cartoon editor. So far from killing off the cartoons.
Still doing now, isn't he?
Well, he became, you know, very well known after some time at the New Yorker. Together we started the Cartoon Bank, which was for all the cartoons that hadn't been used, which allowed them to sort of syndicate their cartoons elsewhere. I started the cartoon issue.
I mean,
the cartoonists, like, made out like bandits, frankly, under my leadership because I loved them. So it was the actual opposite of what he'd expected and feared. But yeah, it was a very difficult first couple of years because I had a lot of opposition. But, you know, I also found that some of the old guard were very welcoming. Like John Updike was wonderful to me, Roger Angel, Janet Malcolm. There were people who were legendary names who actually did support me because they had realized that the New Yorker was actually dying. I mean, it was the readership had got so old. The advertising was falling away and it needed a shot in the arm. And what I was able to do was to, I mean, I actually let go 70 people at the New Yorker, but I hired 40 people who were, I think, every bit as talented. I know they were every bit as talented as the ones who everybody sort of lionized. I mean, you know, I brought David Remnick, of course, who succeeded me as editor. I have done my podcast TBD with Remnick. We had a wonderful time together. I brought Jane Mayer, I brought Malcolm Gladwell, Jeffrey Toobin, Skip Gates.
I mean, these are iconic names now, but back then, how did you find them then?
They were all young writers doing certain things. I mean, you know, Jeffrey Toobin was working as an assistant DA, and I'm very impulsive when I hire people, actually. I mean, I pick something up instantly and I decide I like it. I mean, like, I can tell very quickly whether somebody can write. So if I read something, I think, you know, there's a voice here. There's instincts here. There's something here. We can do something with this guy, even if he hasn't written a great deal. So if in the case of Toobin, he hadn't written a great deal, but I could see that he could really be something because his ideas were so good. I mean, he has tremendously good ideas. Jeffrey Toobin could have easily been the New Yorker editor, actually, because he has terrific ideas. Some writers don't have ideas, as I said, but he has great ideas. Malcolm Gladwell was a book reviewer, just a very interesting mind. And, of course, I think his second piece for us, or it might have even been his first piece, was The Tipping Point, actually, which, of course, is still
in the book,
in the bestsellers charts. I had a lot of terrific editors as well as writers. Henry Finder, I came from a very small magazine at Harvard, recommended by Skip Gates. And he has turned out to be a complete treasure, has been there for the last 25 years. Dorothy Wickenden. I mean, you know, I could go on. They're an extraordinary crowd and they're all still there. That's what's so great in a way that I do feel that a mark of success in life is not only did you do something at work, but what have you left behind you? Who have you brought up? Who have you mentored? Who have you trained? Who have you encouraged? Who have you allowed to flower so that when you go, it's all going to be stronger and stronger. And that is what happened both at Vanity Fair and at the New Yorker. I was able to leave staff, writers, editors, photographers, everyone there who were a stellar, stellar group. And once you've done that, the pedigree of hiring becomes so good, because if you hire an amazing staff, chances are that when they start to kind of tap out and leave, they're going to bring in the other incredible person. It really is about creating culture and about creating DNA that can last a really long time until someone comes in and screws it up.
So what I'm hearing there is that 90% of the job done well is actually in the hiring and firing and creating
really
that
is.
Culture, because without good people, you're screwed.
You're completely screwed. And about a team that complements each other. I mean, I've always found, I mean, I always hired as much on, well, two or three things. I mean, for writers, it was about voice. Do they have voice? Do they have original thinking? You know, you don't just hire someone for how they write, but how they think. And it's also in the case of editors and then the staff who are on, you know, the supporting side of the supporting the writers is temperament too. I mean, I would be very careful to cast, you know, this sort of sensitive writer with this editor who I know has very good people skills or whatever, this sort of tougher minded writer with the editor who's really more of a journeyman editor. You know, you have to really be, to keep your talent, you have to be very much alert to what they need. And you also have to really encourage. The other thing I feel very strongly about is an editor has to really respond quickly and fully to talent. You know, when people write things, they don't want to wait and wait and wait and wait for a response, because writers are very insecure. I know when I write something now, when the tables are turned, you know, I'm every bit as much of a sort of whining, you know, pathetic.
Because you put everything into it.
You put everything into it and you sit there like miserable and think, and fantasizing. He hates it. You know, it's no good. It's never going
to
make.
And the reality is he's probably just not got around to reading it because he's got another 40
right.
emails to get to before.
That's right. And then somehow it's just really hurtful if you then get, you know, it's bad enough when you then don't hear anything and then they don't like it. But then or you just find that it was like they posted it. It went up online and you didn't even tell you. And it's like, that's how much you know, this is our interface, as it were. You can't even send me an email saying, I did like it, I didn't like it, you know. And there's a lack of response, I think, which really can be very corrosive to writers. And you get some very discouraged very quickly.
Now, just before we talk about the Daily Beast briefly, I just wanted to kind of touch on magazines, because I was doing some research for this. And I found a quote where you said that magazines don't even know who to put on covers these days and that they're becoming almost irrelevant.
Well, I think it's a huge problem. Not for this, because the editors are at fault, because there's plenty of great, talented editors around. But the culture is just, it's so fast moving and so oversubscribed with nobodies. And of course, the star culture has died because, you know, the only movies that really get made are the huge kind of Captain Marvel kind of movies. The rest don't really have any commercial impact. So the manufacturing and the minting of stars that were cover star caliber is really been reduced. I mean, the biggest stars today really are music stars, you know, like Lady Gaga, like Beyonce, like Rihanna. I mean, those remain stars because they're sort of big showmen with huge audiences. Movies just don't have those kind of audiences really anymore. And the TV streaming stars are niche, if you like. And so actually trying to find a star who's going to have an impact is in itself difficult. Secondly, because of the digital component, there isn't any surprise or traction anyway from being on a newsstand. I mean, it gets thrown up online a week before it's even available. By the time people see it on the newsstand or get it in the mail, it's just old potatoes. And so there's a kind of slight disappointment. It's not like the excitement of unveiling your cover and it's on the newsstand and people are interested to see what it looks like inside. That's all gone because it's already been like just thrown out for free, feasted upon, as we said, by digital audiences, unpaid for. So it's a lot of issues now about what should be on the cover. And also thirdly, you know, as I said before, you know, news is the zeitgeist. I mean, I think that Vanity Fair did the right thing putting Beto O'Rourke on the cover, because actually they've made a lot of news with it, with that cover story, because they got the news that he's going to run and probably would run, and now he is running, and it was the right cover at the right time, and probably won't lift newsstands because I think newsstand is gone, as I said, but it does at least make the magazine feel that it's right in the crucible of conversation this month, which it hasn't been in some of the other covers.
When Newsweek went back into print, Jim Impoco, who's the then editor, did this podcast, and he said that he viewed the magazine, the physical magazine on the newsstand, as a paper-based banner advert for the website, which I thought was a very interesting insight. But just building on what you said there, though, I think the news and the relentlessness of it is actually presenting a problem for the news. So, for example, we had Paul Royal in recently. He's the editor of the BBC's 10 o'clock news, and his problem as editor of that main, you know, flagship BBC news programme is that he knows all of his viewers already know the news before this bulletin has started because they're on social media. They know everything that Hugh Edwards is going to say for the first 20 minutes.
Right.
So they don't want to be told what's happening. They already want insight.
They do. It's absolutely right. And it puts the burden on the interpretive scoop, as I used to call it at The New Yorker. I would always be asking for that, the interpretive scoop, the new angle on something we knew had happened, or frankly, breaking news that nobody has yet, and that's the only other thing you must do in a publication or in the news on television, is bringing news that people haven't heard before. Now, the interesting thing about TV news, it very rarely does that. Actually, I remember Roger Ailes startled me once by saying to me, "Everything on television is old." And I said to him, "What do you mean?" He said, "You have to understand." He said, "TV follows. You know, it never breaks news." I'm not quite sure why that is, but it's almost as if the TV culture was started by people who felt it was a subsidiary form to print, that print was really the integrity form, the serious form, and they didn't want to put anything on television until it had been covered somewhere else. It's a different philosophy entirely to print, which wants to be first. Television doesn't feel confident to do something until someone else has said it, which is interesting. But of course, also means that it feels pretty stale most of the time. I mean, half the time with cable, you're just watching things you didn't know, as you quite rightly said.
And also, I don't trust the breaking news tickers now on all these rolling news channels, because it's not that it's almost
not
like
breaking news.
It's not, unfortunately. That's the thing. And then if the ticker on Sky News turns yellow, you know, maybe 10 years ago, that would have brought my attention to it, thinking, "Wow, something's happened."
It should be called breaking old news.
Yeah, it's like breaking news. You mentioned the Daily Beast a couple of times. I just wanted to touch on it before we moved on, because I mean, everyone's still trying to make digital news profitable. This, you know, the challenges that you faced then are as relevant now as they were.
Incredible. I mean, you know,
you came closer than most, though, didn't you?
We got sort of close, but it wasn't enough, you know. And you know, when I left, it was losing money. And it's still losing money, you know, 5 years later, whatever it is still losing money. And they've actually been through many publishers, many, you know, business people. And, you know, Barry said to me the other day, you know, it's losing money. It's still losing money. I just said, well, you know, maybe you just got to live with it, you know, because no one has yet really found a model to make news a profit center, because advertisers don't want to be anywhere near stories about Jamal Khashoggi being, you know, chopped into pieces, or you know, a Boeing falling out of the sky. I mean, they don't want to be near that. And so therefore, it's all about paying for it, which is what people used to do, you know. And we now have the subscriber model, which is doing very well for The Times and The Washington Post and others. But it's not ever going to really be a useful model for much less prestigious newspapers, where people just won't pay for it, you know, in the same way. So that is the huge problem. And I think, you know, I was talking to someone the other night who was saying that the things that rescue an industry rarely come from inside. It's like music got rescued by, you know, Daniel Ek at Spotify, or, you know, that it's outside our industry this will be fixed. I mean, I don't think that any publication is going to fix the business model for journalism. It's something about our profession that doesn't allow it to fix this problem. It's going to need to be invented by some sort of technician in Albuquerque or something, who looks at the whole business from a completely different point of view. I mean, it's like the whole Netflix model was kind of an engineer's concept, you know? I mean, I think we get too close to it or something, or we're looking at it the wrong way, but we have not, great minds have looked at this issue and still haven't fixed it.
So could you tell us about a typical week now? I mean, I know there probably isn't such a thing as a typical week, but, you know, you've got lots of projects and responsibilities to coordinate. How do you cram it all in?
Well, I do a lot. I mean, my company, Tina Brown Media, is engaged fully on the Women in the World Summit and other smaller salons throughout the year. You know, we do Toronto and Washington and LA and do these smaller events and also, you know, some custom events. So that's going on. I have a staff of about, you know, 15 or 16 people, and they're always in there. So I always go into the office office, and well, we have a wee workspace like everybody these days, and I spend, you know, might spend a morning dealing with all of that. And then I'm sort of getting ready for my podcast. I always read everything for my podcast. I don't like skipping the book if I have an author, you know, so I'll sit and read it, work on the questions with my wonderful producer, Karen Compton. I spend a lot of time sort of strategizing on how to get guests either for the summits or for the podcast. I'm thinking about doing a new book. So then, if I'm really engaged in writing, I'll get up really early. So, I mean, yeah, it's a lot to cram in, but I'm having a great time, actually. It's been a very happy period for me. And recently moved out of my house on 57th Street where I was for 30 years. And, you know, and that was a big thing to do, to move to our apartment now, smaller apartment at Beekman Place, but the kids have left home and so on. And Harry and I are very cozy. I mean, we were saying the other night that, you know, we're very happy right now in our sort of life and companionship. And, you know, Harry is such a wonderful, fun person to live with, quite honestly. I mean, you know, 35 years later, he's still my favorite dinner partner.
He's a great guy.
I had lunch
with him a couple of weeks ago at his club, and I think you only live about two blocks away from me.
We do.
Because I gave him a lift, and I thought, well, I'd got it, because I had another appointment to go to. I thought, oh, is this going to delay me by X, you know?
Yeah, but we joined the River Club, yeah, which is this kind of hugely sort of posh club, but it's got a wonderful swimming pool.
It has, yeah.
And he loves it, and he goes there every day and has his swim. He does his 30 or 40 lengths. It's incredible. He's 90 years old, and he gets up. Yesterday, he comes out for breakfast with me, because I have to go out for my breakfast with my news buffet of newspapers and iPad, and we sit there and we devour it all together, and it's our time together. Then he'll come back, and he writes his, you know, book review for the New York Times. Then he goes off and he swims his 40 lengths, and he has a nap, and we go off for, you know, a dinner, and he's just unchanged. It's absolutely amazing.
He's living the dream.
He's
right?
living
I mean,
the
that
dream.
Sounds ideal to me. And what is it like to journalists living in the same house then? Is it like a friendly competition? Is there like Chinese walls where you don't...
Well, no, the only time we have any conflict is when he is obsessed with a story and I'm reading another one. And so he'll go like, this freaking editorial in the New York Times, you know, about, you know, I don't know, Michael Cohen or whatever. Like, what do you think? I go, well, I'm actually reading this piece about Saudi at the moment. I'll get to it. No, but I want to know what you think about this. So just look at this. And he starts reading it to me. I go like, Harry, I'm doing Saudi right now. Yeah. You do your Michael Cohen. I'll do my Saudi. Then we'll switch. But I cannot read alongside you.
I like that. My wife and I bicker a lot, but I see that as a good thing. And, I mean, you're very politically aligned, and I would say both equally passionate about trying to change the world for the better, frankly.
Yeah, well, I mean, Harry gets sort of outraged. We get outraged about similar things. I mean, he gets extremely outraged when he feels that journalism is not persistent enough in getting to the stories. I mean, one of his great bugbears, and I think he's right, actually, is... you know, in England, the journalism does profiles really well. I mean, there are profiles that are packaged in ways that are very sort of reader-friendly about anybody new and important in the public eye. And for some reason, American journalism doesn't really do that in the newspapers. I mean, they don't have a really great profile in the paper. I mean, they do sometimes in the magazine, like, I don't know, when you want it, like of Mitch McConnell or of, you know, Adam Schiff, or, you know, you constantly find that you just don't know who these people really are. And then something happens and their life story comes out. You think, my God, I never knew that about him. I never knew that he was like a vet who, you know, his brother was shot in Vietnam or whatever the whole thing it was. And you just wish that you knew more about people in a sort of really deep way. And I think American journalism isn't really very good at that. I don't think it's a tradition of newspapers at any rate, or of sort of the daily news cycle. Magazines do it, but you know, the magazines are now thin on the ground, so you don't get nearly enough of learning who people are in a very deep way. You know, at the end of the day, who is Ilhan Omar actually? You know, you just read constantly about a person, constantly, but you really don't have it all put together in a way that makes you know who they are. And so he gets kind of quite exercised about that sometimes.
I think rightly so, actually. What are you going to do over the next sort of 5 to 10, 15 years? Are you going to, because I mean, what you've done is incredible already. You're going to scale things up, carry on, move into different directions. So I'm interested.
I really want to do another two or three books now. I mean, I feel the faster and crazier the world gets, the more I feel I'm entering slightly into my hermit phase, let's put it that way. I mean, I sometimes dream about, you know, living, you know, stomping around in, you know, old shoes and living in the country, going back to England, you know, writing my books, living in Cotswolds. I mean, I have still got a little bit of a yen for that. I get very homesick sometimes these days, which I didn't used to do for before. So I still think of England as my real spiritual base. You know, we do talk about that. And then other times I just think, you know, I love New York so much, love my whole life and world. I would miss it tremendously because it's the center still of, I have so many amazing friends that I know here and so many worlds that I can move between. Actually having the podcast, it's really fun to sort of reanimate my passion for books and, you know, people that I wouldn't necessarily be coming across in my work with the live work I'm doing. So this is quite a contented phase, and my kids are my best friends, and it's all very nice.
And last question then, if I may, is what advice would you give to someone starting out their career in journalism if, you know, if you had a young niece or a friend, you know, that was just starting out and they asked you for advice, what would it
be? Yeah, I would say go somewhere really small that needs you. You know, don't get seduced by some big brand. Like, don't go and work for, like, I don't know, BuzzFeed or something. Go and work for some small publication or some, you know, first of all, with somebody who can teach you something. It's like, who's going to be your teacher in that place? You know, you want to work with someone who's got a lot of quality and rigor and you can be around them, A, and B, something where you can have to do a lot because there's nobody else. You know, if there's four of you putting out some little magazine or something or some small startup or whatever, you are going to learn so much more than if you are working, I don't know, at the New York Times, sort of getting somebody's coffee for years and doing their schedule. You know, it's great. And the third thing is just like the rigor of work. Just don't expect it to come without that, you know. And that's my three big maxims of the day, Paul.
You know, it's been an incredibly enjoyable conversation. Thank you for being a guest on the second best podcast in the world after TBD with Tina Brown.
Oh, you are very sweet.
Well, thank you. It's been hugely enjoyable.
Thank you so much.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.